This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health, Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Now, Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Like to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413, 800-462-7413. Some of our topics we'll be talking about among the calls.
A very exciting topic. Pretty. If you are pretty, if you're a pretty couple, if you're gorgeous, what sort of a child do you produce?
What do you mean?
Well, we'll talk about that.
A pretty child.
Oh, we'll talk about that. That's what we're going to talk about.
Okay, and?
Very interesting research that may affect people who want to have children, you know, attractiveness counts in life.
And?
Dementia. The other side of the spectrum. Is there a way to look at the risk factors for your developing dementia? Some very interesting data that talks about
that. Could be really interesting.
Well, interesting on the other side of lifetime. If you're going to have a child, it might be the first side you care about.
So everything from birth to death.
That's right. From birth to death on
this
show.
Right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
There you go.
In between, we like to eat.
Yeah, that's right. In between, we like to eat. And this is chicken and fennel sauce. Fennel is a very, very interesting herb to use. It's an herb. It's a vegetable. It's a root vegetable, really. And it's very interesting. And it has that smell of anise, sort of like licorice, and it's wonderful.
Coming up, that's our recipe. Again, 800-462-7413. If you would like to talk with Zorba, a listener with us now, Zorba, in Joplin, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom.
What's up?
My question is on cholesterol.
Okay.
We have an annual health fair at work, and I had my blood drawn, and I got back the results. And my overall cholesterol is 231, but my good HDL is 106. And
it's
in the normal range is like 29 to 67. So I thought, well, perhaps because my HDL is so good, I don't have to worry about it.
An HDL cholesterol of 106 is definitely super high.
I think that's a record,
definitely
isn't
super high. Well,
it may be a record. Maybe a world record.
So your total cholesterol again was, what was the number?
231.
And what was your LDL or bad cholesterol?
LDL is 115.
115. So you're great. You're how old?
A 50.
Yeah, those are great numbers. You know, I'll tell you one of the ways that people can look at cholesterol, because they always have the questions, what about HDL? What about LDL?
Right, right.
There's a heart attack risk calculator, and there's several of them out, but they're based on the National Cholesterol Education Program campaign. And if you go to the NIH website and you write down heart attack risk calculator, or if you Google it, this will basically pop up. And on that calculator, they ask a few things. What's your blood pressure? What's your total cholesterol? Are you a smoker and so on? And what's neat about it is you can put in things like, if I'm a smoker, how does that change my risk?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about the National Cholesterol Education Campaign is the LDL or bad cholesterol. For many people, that number is really 130 or less. If you're a diabetic or you have previous heart disease, we want to get it below 100. And in fact, the lower the LDL, if you've had a heart attack or if you're a diabetic, the better off you are. Now, HDL cholesterol is the horse of a different color. Get that above 40, 40 or 50, and you're really doing well. And get that as high as yours, and you're doing fabulously.
Okay.
So your HDL is wonderful, but your LDL is that goal. It's below 130. It doesn't have to get lower than that unless you've got other risk factors. Now, you don't smoke cigarettes, right?
I don't, right.
Because you listen to public radio, and no one listens to public radio smokes cigarettes. How about exercise? Do you exercise at all?
7 days a week.
7 days a week. See, typical public radio listener exercises 7 days a week. Heart disease in your family. You must have people who live a long life on either your mom or your dad's side.
Dad's side's pretty good. Both died of cancer, but no heart disease or anything.
Yeah, but no heart disease. I mean,
right.
If you've got HDL that's as high as yours, you basically have family that, you know, they die of something else. They don't die of cancer, as you say. They die of cancer. They don't die of heart disease.
Right,
so,
okay.
Yeah, those are great numbers. What'd they say when you had those numbers?
They didn't. That's the problem. They just send you the results.
Right.
They send you the advice, see your doctor.
Okay. I'll tell you something. This is something that's inherited. Enjoy it. Just don't, you know, enjoy it and don't ruin it, essentially,
great,
which you haven't by smoking and other things. So.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. His general question, Zorba, on how much you can use the high good cholesterol to balance off the high bad cholesterol.
Well, what happens is this. The good cholesterol sort of gives you a point. You know, and the bad cholesterol can take away points. That's the way to think about it. Now, there's no 100, a cholesterol, an HDL below 100 is really very protective. But no one's quantitated how much more protected it is versus an elevated cholesterol of 50. For instance, 50, 55 is high. Does 110 make it really super high? But generally, if you've got an HDL that high, that means that you've got good genes on your side. And the only thing that can change that is to ruin it. And to ruin it means you're going to smoke cigarettes, you're not going to exercise, you're going to have a lousy diet, you're going to be, you know, obese, you're going to have diabetes, and basically those are the other things. And so you can't really quantitate it, and you can't say, well, I can eat whatever I want to and I don't have to exercise because I've got it. That's not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is I've got a head start. I've got a good set of cards in my hand. If I'm playing bridge or poker, I don't want to ruin it because you've got a great card set.
Got it. A listener with us now, Zorba in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Good day, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Good. The reason for my call is when I worked several years ago at a health food store, I spent a lot of my time reading. And upon reading, I actually noticed some things on fingernails, and I just was wondering if there was any validity to being able to identify nutrient deficiencies from either like the white spots under your fingernails or the ridges in your fingernails, and I just wanted to get sort of a feedback on
that. Yeah, you didn't have much business at the health food store, so you had plenty of time to read.
Well, sometimes it was pretty slow.
Pretty slow at the health food store. Let's start to look at nails.
Yes.
That sounds like a good idea. Very interesting things about nails. First of all, it's almost like iridology, where people look at the irises of the eyes and try to produce how long people are going to live and what their health is like and so on. And I consider iridology to be sort of in the same class as palm reading, where many, many years ago, 100 years ago, people would read palms and say, I can tell you what's going on with your palm by looking at your palm. Nails fit in that same class, where you go to a health food store and they'll say, well, you're deficient in this micronutrient, therefore buy this $20 a month nutrient, which is $240 a year, and it will change your nails, and it's going to take 6 months to a year to see the difference. And when people don't see the difference, they just stop the nutrient and they've spent their money. The answer is yes and no. There's certain nutrient deficiencies where you can see differences in your nails, but they're rare. They're rare deficiencies. And the interesting thing is that a lot of things can produce ridges in nails. A fever, a cold, a sore throat, even stress in your life can make some changes in there. And eating gelatin caps, which my Aunt Myrtle used to eat all the time because she always complained my mother's nails were strong, and my Aunt Myrtle said my nails aren't strong, and she'd have gelatin because she thought gelatin would improve nails. And for the most part, nails change just like hair. Some people have thicker hair. Some people have more vibrant hair. It's really the same with nails. So you see them in health food stores because they want to sell product. You don't see it in doctor's offices because basically they don't want to sell product, and there's not much validity to it. So I've got a question. How many of these nail cures did you sell?
Well, it wasn't necessarily the cure. It was just the literature on, like, the books that I had on file and things like that. A lot of people did buy, like, hair, skin, and nail products. I had a lot of biotin that I recall, and silica, and, you know, horsetail rush herb, and
right, because people are very, I mean, people are interested in making sure their nails are strong and nice looking, especially women. Guys are not as interested, but women are more interested in that. And one thing that people neglect to know is that if your nails are weak and tend to be brittle, using nail polish can make a big difference, because basically you're putting a plastic top on top of it. Even for guys, obviously, clear nail polish is going to look different than red or purple. But that is an artificial way of helping your nails stay stronger, and I always recommend that to people. And also, when we look at nails, avoiding toxins to nails. Biggest toxin we have is dishwashing detergent. For a lot of people, that begins to dissolve the keratin, which is what nails are made of. So using those wonderful latex gloves can make a difference to your nails.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
You're welcome. Or a dishwasher.
Or a dishwasher. That's another way to do it.
And people still read palms. Haven't you ever had your palm read?
I have had my palm read. And you know what? I wanted to believe that the person actually knew my future, but it didn't work out that way.
Well,
I just wish that was the case.
I did a few years ago.
Yeah,
I'm a very fascinating person. And I'm going to live a really long life.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, you are.
800-462-7413. Want to talk with Zorba? 800-462-7413. Well, Zorba, you mentioned research on good-looking people,
yes,
pretty good-looking people.
Good-looking people. You know, it's something that Americans have fascination for. All you have to do is, I know this doesn't interest you, Tom, but if you go to the magazine rack and you just look at the front of magazines, you will see a plethora of magazines that show beautiful times, having beautiful children.
Absolutely,
everyone
right.
is happy and joyous, and of course, that's the way beautiful people are. They're just happier than the rest of us. The rest of us who are ugly people really are not having the same
beautiful time. What's this research?
Well, first of all, can you really rate attractiveness? And there's some very interesting cross-cultural studies that show there are certain things that are objective things that rate attractiveness that include in many, many cultures around society, high cheekbones, eyes that essentially are more clear, eyes that are not cloudy. For instance, we know that cataracts and so on and people with deformities are not rated as attractive. Yeah. So they looked at attractiveness.
And these researchers say that attractiveness is a universal.
Well, and they looked at some universal traits of attractiveness.
Yeah.
So you took guys who are tall and who are straight tall and are not bent over
right.
and appear to be strong are more attractive. Women appear to be more attractive if they have roundness, if they're not overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And so they looked at it. They looked at a 5-point scale of attractiveness, and then they tried to look at babies. And lo and behold, what they found was that attractive people tend to produce girls. 56% of the time they produce girls versus unattractive people who tend to produce boys.
As the firstborn.
That's right. So if you're attractive,
you're
a little more likely, 56% versus, boys, which are more likely to be in the unattractive girls. And that's it. That's what we learned
from
the study.
Well, how many people did they look at here?
Millions of people. No, I don't know. It didn't tell me how many people actually looked at it. But the issue is rather interesting because, first of all, if you believe the data, and I don't know if I believe the data because
yeah.
I don't know if you can really look at attractiveness and make it universal, but if you believe the data, then what happens is that there must be something evolutionarily important about these points of attractiveness in that they'll produce girls as an offspring, and what is the evolutionary import of that, and,
mm-hmm.
and what does that mean? Frankly, I think this is a very good example of research that is spurring us to buy more magazines to look at attractive people. And it's really a hoax. And this is an attractiveness because we'll buy more people magazine in us.
So you don't put much.
I don't find it an attractive study
for me. Your firstborn was Zach.
Yeah, my firstborn was Zach. Therefore, he's a boy. Therefore, we are less likely to be attractive. Let's go to the converse of that. If your firstborn is a boy, you're much more likely to be an ugly person than if your firstborn is a girl. Of course. And for years we've known that. If you have all boys, what does that mean?
That means
you must be ugly. And if you have all girls, that means you must be a pretty girl.
And my only born was Eden.
That's
a
right.
girl.
That's right. And she was a girl. And
yeah,
therefore,
so.
That's right. One for Tom, zero for Zorba. We got it, baby.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. A listener in St. Louis, Missouri with us now. Hi.
Hi, guys.
What's up?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've just recently started my first permanent full-time desk job, and I'm worried that it's making it so that I can't exercise because I've noticed that, I'll work out in the morning, and as I sit in my chair all day, my knee starts to ache, and it gets to, it's really subtle at first, and it gets worse and worse, and it gets to where I just can't exercise for the next couple of days. And I'm worried about this because I like to exercise. I'm very active. And, I find, especially because I'm sitting all day, I need to move. It helps me concentrate and that sort of thing. So I'm wondering if there's anything to this, like if actually sitting in a chair can really make my knee hurt, and if there's anything I can do about it.
Yeah, I'd quit the job.
Yeah.
It's very simple. Quit the job. Go to exercise. Of course, you'll have to live on the streets because you won't have any money to pay for your apartment. It's an interesting quandary. So you sit at your job. You're at a computer. What are you
uh-huh.
doing?
I'm a lawyer, but I'm doing mostly transactional stuff, and especially because I'm new, it's most of the stuff is just on the computer.
Right. So you're there from the morning to the evening. One of the problems, there are two issues. First of all, exercising in the morning is great, tough to do because you have to get up early in the morning. But you're a morning person, right? That's how you can exercise.
Well, no, I've just been sort of making myself do it because I find that if I don't do it in the morning, it's hard to fit it in any other time.
Right. And actually, studies have shown that people who exercise in the morning are much more likely to continue to exercise. probably because they basically fit their exercise into their program, and that makes a big issue versus exercising in the evening. But getting back to the other issue, what do you do during the day? You're sitting at your desk for a very long period of time, and that's where this ache is coming from. And you have to try to figure out a method of where you're going to get up and start to move your body during the day. And it doesn't have to be exercise, but it has to be after an hour or an hour and a half in the morning, you get up and you walk around and do something else. And that's the quandary, and it's the problem of sitting at a desk all day. Now, you can take an anti-inflammatory, like two Aleve tablets, like Aleve. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. The generic is great. It lasts for a long period of time. But you don't want to do that unless you have to. And if the ache is bad, I would use the Aleve. But I try to figure out some way of doing an exercise at your desk. Can you get up during the day and walk and
do stuff? I feel like I do. You know, like maybe once in the morning and once in the afternoon, I'll kind of walk around the block. Mm-hmm. Or if I can't even do that, I'll just kind of walk around the office.
Yeah, what's your chair like? What kind of a chair do you have?
It's just like a typical, you know, office chair.
What do you put under your feet? You don't have anything under your feet.
No, I mean, anymore, I've started dragging a second chair over I can kind of keep my foot up.
I'll tell you, it's not even necessarily a second chair. How many lawyers are in your office? A lot of lawyers?
Yeah, only like 50.
Okay, so what you want to do is you want to talk to there's a person in your office who's in charge of the chairs and other things. And you can buy, it's a step that you can put under your desk. It's not really a step. It's a board that is a triangle. And you put your feet against that and you can exercise and move your legs. So sometimes your legs are right under your chair. And then other times they're sort of up at a 45 degree angle. And that can make a big difference because what it does is it changes the way you sit with your legs. And a lot of people use these. I don't know what the name of it is. I'm sure somebody's going to send it to us by email. But these are basically they're little wooden things. We have them in our office. One of my partners had lots of problems with her leg muscles, and she put it underneath there. And so what she did was half the day, basically, she'd have her feet down on the ground. The other half, she'd have it on there, and she basically moved back and forth. And they are stoops, but they're not just a stoop that goes there to stand up. They're at a 45 degree angle. Your office manager may know about it. If not, call up a business supply store and find out. That's your answer.
Okay.
Seriously, that'll make a difference because it's that positioning. The other answer is, after an hour and a half, get up and walk around the office and do something. Sit at the desk for 3 to 4
hours.
Can't
you get one of those lawyer jobs like I see on TV? They're always standing up and pacing around and going, where were you on the night of?
And very importantly, those lawyer jobs, they're always having intimate conversations in bathrooms. You notice that? They go to bathrooms and then they have intimate conversations and there's somebody else sitting in the john in the bathroom, you know.
She doesn't know about
listens.
That.
No, don't they do that in all law firms? Isn't that where the really important conversations take place?
Yeah, maybe in a few years. I don't know.
Good
luck.
But good luck.
Thank you.
This. Walk around the office. Get this, whatever you call it. It's not a stoop, but somebody's going to let me know.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Speaking of knees, Zorba, we have a message from our Zorba pastor on your health inbox. It comes to us from Tom in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Tom might have a tip to solve another aching knee problem. He writes, on a recent show, you talked with a fellow who had knee pain whenever he drove in his car. Remember that?
That's right.
I kept waiting for you to ask him which pocket he kept his billfold in.
Oh, correct.
But you never did. Billfold in my front pocket when I'm driving for a long time.
Right.
And that can affect
Absolutely. It affects sciatica. He brings up a really, really good point. A lot of people on long car trips, guys, have big billfolds, which are filled with lots of cards and other things. And they're hard, and they press in the sciatic notch, or they press along the back of the pelvis, and they produce pain. And he's right. Taking that billfold out, putting it in your front pocket can make a big difference. You're not as likely to be, you know, have that billfold ripped off if somebody gets into the truck with you and talks to you or something.
I'm surprised you didn't, as big as your billfold is, come up with that.
Filled with cash, Tom. With cash.
Anyway, you don't need a big wallet to send us your questions, comments, or tips. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number if you have a question for Zorba. Our recipe coming up soon.
Good. It's chicken and fennel sauce. Fennel, something that you've got in your kitchen right now, I'm sure. Fennel, something you use every day. No, fennel is unusual, so we'll talk about it.
And more of your questions, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, our number, if you have a question for Zorba, call 800-462-7413. Zorba will answer your question. It's recipe time.
Yes, it is, Tom.
Chicken
yes,
and is. Fennel sauce.
That's right, chicken what, and fennel.
What's that stuff?
What's this? This is fennel. Now, I know that your mother probably never had, my mother never had fennel. In fact, I still remember when we discovered squash in our family because my mother never had squash.
My mother never had fennel. My wife never had fennel.
Right.
I never had
this
fennel.
This is that fennel. This is fennel, and I want you to look at it, Tom. It's a wonderful fennel bulb.
It's kind of pretty.
Oh, yeah, fennel is quite pretty. Fennel is interesting. It's found all over the world, from Egypt and India, of course, obviously. I haven't brought this from Egypt or India, but it grows, and fennel has the smell of almost licorice. Now, as we learned a couple of weeks ago, licorice really isn't made with licorice anymore, but fennel is made with fennel, and when I cut it, I want you to listen to it. Now, listen. See, I'm cutting it.
It's very exciting.
I'm trying not to cut
very
my hand.
Very exciting radio.
And I'm smelling it. I want you to smell this now, because I'm going to bring these over. Right. Smell it. Put it right up to your nose and smell it. What does it smell like?
Oh, it does smell like licorice.
That's right. It really does smell
not
like licorice.
Not as strong.
No, not as strong. That's exactly it. And in a recipe, if you take the, of course it's dripping because it's
very
pretty.
It's a very pretty plant.
It's very pretty. Yeah, well, you can take the top part.
Is the bulb part the part
that
you use
in the
recipe?
The bulb is the bottom. It's this bottom part.
Yeah,
I've now cut between the top stalks, and the top stalks are very, very good. In a fresh salad, they give it a very bright, zingy taste. It smells really good. And the bottom part, what we're going to do is take the bottom part and we are going to steam it. And it adds a very, very interesting taste to boneless, skinless chicken
breast. It doesn't taste like licorice, does it?
It does not taste like licorice at all, but it has a very interesting, it's an aromatic, it has an interesting aroma, and it's almost like a root vegetable. When we cook it, it has a different taste, but that smell, that slight aromatic smell of licorice pervades it. And if you don't tell the person that you're cooking for what's in it, they won't necessarily know, and they'll say, what is this taste? And it's a very interesting taste. I happen to like fennel, but you'll find, just like licorice, some people like the smell.
Can you eat it raw?
I've never eaten it raw. I mean, the top part you can eat raw in salads. It's the bottom part. Yeah, okay, here, cut a little piece. Let's hear. Let's see. Here, we're going to do it. We can see.
Who says I'm boring?
I can't believe it. You won't touch tofu, but you'll pound it out. See how good it would be in a salad?
That's kind of good, isn't it?
Actually, it's not bad. Here, have another piece.
That's all right. I'm fine. It is good.
Pretty good. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be eating on the air.
Does it taste like that cooked?
No, it has a different taste cooked. It has the same smell. I use the top part in salads after I steam the bulb. So that's what I would do. I would use that in a nice salad, maybe with some tomatoes and cucumbers, a little olive oil, a little vinaigrette. Delicious.
That's pretty good. All right, let's do the recipe.
Chicken in fennel sauce.
Right.
Four chicken breasts, boneless, skinless.
So this will serve four, I'm assuming.
That's right. Or one person who's really hungry.
Yeah, right. Four chicken breasts, boneless and skinless.
Salt and pepper.
S&P.
And always use pepper that you ground. Do not use pepper that is pre-made. Three fennel bulbs that you cut into quarters. So once again, you cut off the tops.
Three of those things.
That's right. You cut off the tops. Use the tops in a salad somewhere else. It'll stay for 2 or 3 days in the refrigerator if you don't cut it up. Take the bottom and cut the fennel bulbs into quarters.
Now, I do grocery shop, even though I don't cook.
You can buy this.
Can you find that in
a lot of grocery stores? Not in all grocery stores, but good grocery stores, you've never noticed it. It's actually been there. But in the summer, if you go to a farmer's market, you will always find somebody, almost always, I shouldn't say always, almost always find somebody who's selling fennel because it's very easy to grow. And, of course, in natural food stores, you can find fennel.
Right, I got it. So three fennel bulbs cut into quarters.
Tablespoonful of extra virgin olive oil.
One big tea olive oil.
That's right. Extra virgin, always the best. I now buy my olive oil either from a local grower or over the net. You can get really, really good olive oil for not a huge amount of money, but you often have to buy it by the gallon to do it. And then I put it in smaller containers.
Okay.
Three tablespoonfuls of shallots, finely chopped. It's about three shallots.
Three big tea shallots.
That's right. Three.
Finely chopped.
That's right. You're going to take three tomatoes cut into quarters.
Okay. Take three tomatoes cut into quarters.
That's right. A cup of veggie stock. You can buy that in every grocery store.
1 cup of vegetable stock.
2 tablespoonfuls of dill, preferably fresh, but dry dill is just fine for this.
2 big tea dill.
And a teaspoon of coriander seeds.
A little tea coriander seeds.
That's right. So take the chicken to taste. You're either going to grill the chicken to your liking, or you're going to cook it, we'll say broil it, or you're going to saute it with salt and pepper. So the chicken is now cooked.
Okay.
And for this particular recipe, if you feel like going outside and it's a beautiful day, going outside and grilling it will give that extra added sort of grilled flavor.
Yeah.
But you can easily do it in a little olive oil if you want to, or you can broil it, but salt and pepper. Now, steam the fennel for 5 minutes or until slightly tender. That's that's about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a separate saute pan, heat the olive oil at medium-high heat, add the shallots, and cook it until soft. That's about a minute. Then add the tomatoes, add the fennel, and add the vegetable stock, and then you cook it and reduce that heat and cook for about 10 minutes. Then you remove from the heat and then add the dill and coriander. So that's added. It's not cooked in. You add the dill and coriander afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, top each chicken breast with 1/4 of the fennel sauce. So you take about 1/4 of the sauce of the fennel, put it on top of the chicken breast, and put and serve it, and it will have a very interesting taste on the top of that chicken. It
After really having tasted that fennel, that sounds kind of interesting. I bet
it's
that's
very,
good.
Very interesting. Fennel is it's not a maligned veggie, but it's not used very much at all, and it fits sort of into that vegetable bulb type category. And you'll like it. I happen to like this a lot.
Give it a try. Let us send you that recipe. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, our zip code 53706. Please enclose a self-addressed, stamped, updated, stamped, business-sized envelope, and we'll send the recipe along to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org.
That's our toll-free number if you'd like to talk with Zorba. Give us a call. A listener joins in now from Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, thanks a lot for taking my call. I did want to say that I really enjoy your program. I think you all represent the best of what public radio has to offer.
How nice is that? Thank you very much.
Well,
thank
sure, you.
You
bet.
Mm-hmm.
And here I've got a question about, I guess you'd call it an herbal sweetener. I've been trying to improve my diet lately, and somebody gave me a book. I haven't read the book, but I did find a little recipe in there for smoothies.
Mm-hmm.
And this recipe calls for the stuff called stevia, S-T-E-V, as in Victor, I-A.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sweetener. It's just a little bit goes a long way. I actually went down to my health food store and bought some and did a little checking on it. It's about 200 times more powerful than sucrose. It has no calories. It's a leaf extract. Most of it comes from South America. Very popular in Japan and elsewhere, but I understand that it's not approved for use in the U.S. by the FDA except as a dietary supplement because its toxicological properties are unknown. And so here we've got a situation thus, and I've spoke to another number of people. Nobody seems to have heard it.
Well,
heard
Zorba knows about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, actually, I know a lot about stevia.
Okay,
stevia.
Well, great, because here you've got the opportunity to either make or break
stevia.
Stevia,
that's it. That's it. In fact, I ought to produce Zorba Pastor's stevia and sell that on the market.
Hey, there you go.
That would be an excellent.
Is it any good? I mean, is it good for
you? Yeah, stevia actually, the reason why stevia was not brought to the market as something that would be used as a sweetener is there's no money in it. You can't patent it, and so nobody's going to be interested in actually getting it approved by the FDA as a sweetener because if you can't make money, why are you going to spend, you know, those millions of dollars in research to prove that it's safe and effective? So you can sell it as a supplement, but it's never going to be tested because, as I said, there's not money in having a monopoly on producing it. Very common in Japan. There's no evidence that it causes any, that it has any bad toxicological properties at all. Very interesting. I just recently read a number of articles about sweeteners. And, you know, we think of sweet as simply a sort of, in a monolithic term, that there's something that's either sweet or not sweet. And in fact, there are different ways the brain appreciates sweet. And approaching the sweetness of sugar turns out to be, and sucrose is common table sugar, turns out to be something that we like. And stevia has a different type of a sweetener taste. place, just as NutraSweet, which is, you know, which is made of protein, just as Splenda, which is a sugar, something that is derived from sugar. They all have different amounts of sweetness and how we would rate them. Stevia is fine to use. I think it's safe and effective. Very commonly used in Japan. You can use it. It's not that expensive to use, and enjoy it, and it will cut down on your calories. So,
great.
So it is not toxicologically bad. It's not been proved to be bad, so the FDA, you know, won't approve it. But the fact is, if the FDA had an issue with it, they would already take it on and put it on a ban
list. Well,
I
still don't get, I kind of get the patent thing you're talking about. I still don't get why, if it's so good, why somebody doesn't market it.
Well, they do market it. They market it in health food stores.
I mean, more commonly.
Well, that's a good question, Tom. And that's why people are waiting for you, Tom, to put the capital behind the new push to market Stevia. Why don't they try to market it? I don't know. There's an opportunity out there for an entrepreneur listening to this show to bring Stevia into the America's table so we can use it.
Could some guy named Steve discover this?
I have no idea. I think it's the name of the plant, but I'm not really sure. So thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate
thank
the
you.
Call. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. A listener now in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
I've been listening to your show for so long and always wanted to call in and didn't do it. Anyhow, mm-hmm. this time I did.
Yeah.
I've had this ongoing sort of debate with my daughter and my granddaughter about my granddaughter's weight.
How old is she?
She's 9 and a half.
Okay.
I can't tell you how much she weighs. I don't know. She probably weighs about 50 pounds, but I'm not sure. I just know she's below average.
50 pounds?
My question is, she always says, like when she's outside, no, I'm not cold. I don't need to wear a sweater. And I always say to her, Mom, don't you think she should put on a sweater? She's wearing off calories by being cold or by using up her heat. And if the calories measure heat, then I'm contending that I'm right, although I guess we should go by how she feels.
Well, first of all, calorie is a measure of heat. That's how calorie is defined. It's defined as that. And you do burn off calories if you're outside and you're colder. You burn it off by shivering. Mm-hmm. And that when you shiver, you're actually using your muscles to elevate your heat. And we do use more heat when we're outside, when our body
is 50 pounds light for a 9-year-old?
Well, you know, there's a height and weight chart, and she may be low on the chart.
She's just below average on both of them.
Yeah, if she's just below average.
She's a small little girl, but I have to add she is healthy.
Yeah, but the reality, right. And the reality is 5% of the population is at that other end of the curve, especially as they're growing, where they are petite or they're small and they're underweight. Yeah. But she may be just below average. You know, half of the people are below average and half the people are above mm-hmm. average. You know, that's 50% of the population. But why are you concerned about her weight? Tell me, I'm not quite clear what you're concerned about with
I
this.
Think that she's underweight.
You may be concerned that she's underweight, but going outside and not dressing properly is not going to make her heavier because those number of calories are not that great. It's related to food.
Okay.
You know,
well then,
I mean, it's the amount of food that she's eating. And of course, that's an issue in America, usually
Zorba,
on the other side.
Zorba. If grandma says she should put on a sweater, she should put on a
right,
sweater.
Right. That's exactly it. Your grandma. You wanted to put on a sweater.
Yeah, she
that's
should put exactly the sweater on. I mean,
You're right. Sorry. Time out. I'm interfering with the most important relationship, grandma, that grandma grandchild relationship. And you should eat. You should have some food. You should enjoy. Do you see her on and off at a regular basis? Are you nearby?
Yes, I do.
You see her every day?
No.
Every other day?
Probably.
Ah, I see, on a regular basis. And so, and you guys go out and do things. Why don't you go out? Why don't you start taking her to the malt shop? Take her to a shop, get her a milkshake, get her a malt, fan her up, give her some ice cream.
And
come on over to grandma's house. I have 4 different kinds of cookies, 3 different kinds of
no,
cake.
No,
and I've
I don't feed
cream.
Her stuff like that.
No, but that's the way to get her fat. If you want to fan her up so that she's, you can't see her
oh,
rib,
grandma,
you get her heavy, give her
Her mom ought to be listening to Zorba Pastor on
right.
your health, too.
You've got to get her mom to do it, too. The fact that she's healthy, is good. So, well, it's neat that you're nearby to see with your grandchild. That doesn't happen every day. In the U.S. today, often grandchildren are far away in a different spot. So.
Oh, well, we have just exactly the opposite.
Yes. So
tell her Zorba says you're right.
There you go. That's exactly it. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very Bye-bye. Much, and I'm so happy to get on. I love, 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 love your show.
Oh,
thank you.
Thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot. 800-462-7413. Some interesting research coming up and our medical myth buster of the week coming up as well. More of your calls, too. here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, 800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. But before our next call, Zorba, this seems important to me. Researchers have a new way to score a person's risk for dementia.
That's right. Now, we've got to look at dementia in the broad way. Dementia is obviously the inability to think, to be able to remember things, to be able to engage in tasks. And we often associated dementia with Alzheimer's disease. Yeah. In fact, dementia is broader. And half of all dementia is not Alzheimer's disease.
But includes Alzheimer's disease.
Right. But the half of dementia that isn't Alzheimer's disease is disease in the vascular system. In other words, in the arteries, the little arteries and the capillaries, and they plug up and then they don't feel the brain, and as a result, we have little strokes or mini parts of the brain that aren't working, and then we develop this memory loss. And it's not like a regular stroke where you might have one sudden dysfunction. It's dysfunction that occurs over time.
And so these risk factors are?
The risk factors are obesity, cholesterol, and high blood pressure. Those are the risk factors.
Do they sound familiar? Very familiar risk factors.
Very familiar risk factors. And what they did, this particular study, and there are other studies that have shown this too. These are about 1,500 middle-aged people in Finland. They were looked at, initially studied from 1972 until 1987, and then they were re-examined 20 years later, and they looked at the 40 people of that group. These were middle-aged and younger people at the time. They looked at the 40 who developed dementia, and lo and behold, they looked back a whole bunch of years and they found out if they were hypertensive, if their cholesterol was high, if they were overweight, they were much more likely to have dementia. And so the preventive treatments for dementia start with getting your cholesterol under control with diet and with cholesterol drugs, getting your blood pressure under control with diet, with exercise, with stress reduction, with drugs if necessary,
yeah.
Getting your obesity under control with food, yeah. And exercise.
But this is, in a way, kind of a good news story because the same things that you want to do to keep your heart healthy will keep your mind healthy.
And now, on the other side, there's data from the Alzheimer's side that shows that regular doses of anti-inflammatory drugs, such as an Aleve tablet once or twice a day, may reduce the risk. Regular dose of aspirin may reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And regular learning, doing crossword puzzles, if you like them. I happen to hate them, but if you like them,
I don't like
Sudoku, that's okay. But using your brain, the Nunn study has shown using your brain will also help reduce the risk of Alzheimer's on that other side. So I think this is a good news story. It means that the same way you get your cardiovascular risk under control, decrease heart attack risk will reduce your risk of Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia.
It seems kind of funny that we haven't come up with these risk factors like 100 years ago.
Well, and that's because this is sort of a story that's unfolding. And I think the good news about it is that if you get your physical body under control, then your mental body from your brain is also going to be under control, and the risk of dementia is going to be significantly less.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, if you'd like to talk with Zorba. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Seymour, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, guys.
What's up?
Hey, I love the show.
Thanks.
I'm very happy to get to talk to you today.
Yeah, glad you called. How can we help?
My mom tells me that losing 10 pounds takes 50 pounds of pressure off your spine. Is this true?
Gosh, 10 pounds produces 50 pounds of pressure off your spine. I don't think there's an exact formula like that. I mean, I hate to tell someone's mother that she doesn't necessarily have the information. We do know that people who have back problems, if they lose weight, it definitely takes weight off their back, and we know that that's very, very good. It helps their back pain, makes them feel more comfortable. But I don't think there's a real formula that shows that this is, a 50% reduction off their spine. Certainly something that is useful and something that's really good for you, but there's no exact number. I don't know where she got
Wouldn't it depend on where that weight was? If you lose it in your butt, it would seem
that's right. That's where you find where the weight comes off. So no, I don't think there's an exact formula like that. Sorry, I don't think that's exactly there.
All All right. Well, I'll let her know that.
But losing weight is good for you. Losing weight is good for you. It's good for your body.
If you want to think in those terms, no harm done.
No harm done, and good is done. So.
That's right.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
800-462-7413. A listener in St. Louis, Missouri with us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Good. How can we help you?
I have a question about oral herpes simplex 1.
Okay.
I contracted the virus about 6 years ago and got violently sick, the sickest I've ever been. Fevers up and around 103 for days.
Ooh.
And every partner I've had since this time, I've given it to three people, have also gotten incredibly sick when they've gotten it.
Wow.
So I don't know if it's a completely, or it's a you know, a very harsh strain of it, or why?
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yes, yeah, sounds like it. So you've been passing this around. By the way, every partner you said, I call that passing it around. It's if we look, by the way, at people who have a response to herpes simplex type 1, which are the mouth sore, somewhere last time I read is about 85% or 90% of the population, a huge percentage of the population actually has antibodies to this. So it's actually a common infection, but certainly with this, so you have the kiss of what?
Sickness.
Not the kiss of death, but the sick of herpes. So do you have fun sort of passing this around to people? Hi, I'm going to give you a kiss and we'll see what happens.
I try to be very careful about
discreet.
It.
And discreet.
And that is part of my first question of relating to it is, when are we contagious? I mean, I know that you can be contagious for when the virus sheds at any given time and when you have a sore, but is it any cut in the mouth? Is it any, you know, I sometimes get clogged spit glands. Is it when those get swollen? Are you contagious when you just have any type of problem in your mouth?
Well, first of all, you're contagious before the rash appears. So before the rash appears, you're contagious. So in other words, the rash is there. You were contagious before that day. That's the first thing, you know, when those bubbles.
So there's no warning sign.
There's no warning. And then we know that there's periodic shedding of the virus. So periodically, these viruses shed. We know that, for instance, with women who have herpes simplex type 2, that the virus can shed at any particular time. And whether or not you actually see it in the vaginal vault when you're looking or on the leg where it appears, it doesn't always identify whether or not the virus is shedding. So the reality is it's hard to tell when you're shedding the virus, and that produces the difficult time. You don't want to not engage in kissing somebody who you want to kiss because the virus should be shed. I want to make a snide comment almost like buyer beware, but that's really what the situation is. You know, this virus is really, really common, and you can't depend upon the symptoms to produce that. So a plugged, you know, gland that you feel may actually be the virus sort of erupting. You never develop the rash, but you're shedding some viral particles. One thing that may keep it down is by taking acyclovir, you know, twice a day, 200 milligrams twice a day, which tends to keep the virus at bay. Have you been on acyclovir or valacyclovir or famvir?
No, I haven't. I usually treat it just after I get a sore with a lysine, or sometimes I use lemon balm.
How often do the sores come up? How often do they?
I've been probably having them every month or two for the past 6 years.
Why don't you try acyclovir, which is 200 milligrams twice a day? It may keep these things from erupting completely. Because you've tried it in a non-chemical way and it keeps on erupting, have you thought about trying this to see if you can get the eruption down?
I haven't. I haven't really considered that.
I would consider trying this for 3 to 6 months to just see whether or not you can get the virus down. There are a couple of ways of doing it. You take a higher dose, which would be 400 milligrams 5 times a day. It's the one generic. There are 3 drugs on the market that are approved for either shingles or herpes cold sores. It's acyclovir. That's the only generic, which was Zovirex. And then you can use the other, which is famcyclovir and valacyclovir. And those are the other two, and they're more expensive. And you take 200 milligrams twice a day or 400 milligrams 4 to 5 times a day for 10 days. But I think I would try 200 milligrams twice a day, and I'd take it for 3 to 6 months and see if you can get it to settle down and then stop it. Because these antivirals really do work in stopping it. And if you're getting it once a month and you're sort of in this continuous flare where you're probably just shedding viral particles all the time. So I think I'd consider the drug. I'd consider doing that. Either that, or maybe you ought to wear a little sign on you, a little sticker on there if you kiss me, buyer beware. There may be herpes.
Or a handshake at the end of the
day. Or a handshake at the end of the day. Yeah, a handshake. Nice to see you there. Shake your hands. That's right, a handshake at the end of the date. That's right.
Appreciate the call.
Thanks for your call.
800-462-7413.
You're terrible.
Ready for our medical myth buster?
Yes, I am.
Today's myth has to deal with that old warning that drinking too much soda makes brittle bones. I've heard of that one. I think we've all heard of that one. Is this true, or is it a myth that we use to scare off kids from drinking too much pop?
Right. Kids and adults. Well, it turns out it's a myth. Drinking soda does not produce brittle bones. Now, let's look at the data, see what the data shows. Where did that come from? Well, there are a couple studies that seem to show that when you drink caffeine, you may essentially be excreting more calcium. And studies have shown, because soda contains caffeine, obviously coffee does and some tea, that when you put people in a controlled environment and you give them caffeinated beverages, be it coffee or tea or soda, they do have minimal amounts of increased calcium that they excrete in the urine. But these are very, very small amounts, can be easily replaced by eating a proper diet. And that's where it is. It's a diet issue. Children who grow up drinking lots of soda do not drink milk, and therefore do not have enough calcium in their body as they're growing up, and that might produce brittle bones.
Yeah.
That's a real issue. In other words, drinking too much soda and not drinking those 3 to 4 glasses of milk or having the equivalent of dairy products is an issue, because we know a growing spine needs calcium, and we know that in girls it's very important because they often do not get that calcium.
The trouble is, though, if you don't let the kids drink the soft drinks, which my mom never let me drink soft drinks very much anyway, it isn't a given that the kids are going to run to the fridge and get a glass of milk.
Well, there are two things. First of all, kids tend to drink drinks. And the fact is, if you look at milk marketing boards and things like that, they do, when they market it correctly, kids will start to drink more milk if they're encouraged to do it. The issue, there's a big issue with soda. Number one, it's worthless. It's worthless junk food. I mean, come on. You know, whether it's high fructose corn syrup that has lots of calories, it's a junk food, and we should be discouraging our kids from drinking soda all the time because they drink it all the time. And if we simply substitute orange juice and other things like that, it also has a lot of calories, and that's what's producing childhood obesity, and that's a major issue. The issue, though, is calcium, and we have to encourage our children to get more calcium, and that's through milk, cheese, yogurt, and those are appropriate things for children to eat to take their calories. And you're right, they're not going to run to the refrigerator, but the fact is, if you offer it to them, they're more likely to drink it. And if you take away the soda and do it, because parents are, even though kids don't always follow what they say, obviously they're still in charge and kids still look up to them.
Yeah, you're sick of hearing this. I know I've told this story before. I was a kid. My mom and I went to the cousins for a holiday, and the cousins kept soda pop in the refrigerator, which we didn't do at home.
Right.
I, of course, wanted the soda pop. Uh-huh. My mom made me. How cool can you be? It made me drink 8 glasses of water before I could go and get
8 glasses of water before you could drink the soda pop?
Yes.
How old were you? You couldn't have been a teenager.
No.
You could not have been a teenager. Otherwise, you would have had a few words with your mother.
No, I'm talking 7 or 8 years old.
Right, 7 or 8 years, still following her lead. 8 glasses of water. Gosh. Your mother was a hard taskmaster, wasn't she?
Although I think I fudged on it, and I think she didn't call me on it, and I think
I'm sure you got that pop.
Well, if you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, or if you have a question that you think could stump our favorite family doc, or if you just have a tip for us, we'd love to hear from you. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Again, 1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free phone number. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Columbus, Georgia. Hi.
Hello there. How are y'all today?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, a couple of programs ago, you were talking about soda, as in plain soda water, and then you got to talking about running around with seltzer bottles squirting each other, and I got to thinking, is there a difference between soda water and seltzer water, and if there is, what is it?
I don't remember that. Did we talk about squirting each other?
Oh, sure. We used to do that all the time. Run around when we were kids. We haven't known each other that long. You know, soda, seltzer is seltzer is seltzer. Basically, it's carbonated beverages, and it's carbon dioxide that's put in there either, you know, somewhere along the line. And there's no difference at all between club soda, except in
the
taste of the bubbles. The sweetness, of course, that's in there. And the size of the bubbles can make a difference in terms of taste. But ultimately, it's carbon dioxide that's dissolved in the water. And you open it up and it changes the partial pressure and the carbon dioxide begins to fizzle. And then we love the taste. But running around squirting, I do remember as a kid doing that, running around with soda. Don't you remember doing that as a kid, running around and shaking up a bottle of soda and then squirting it at someone?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
A little bit?
Well, I didn't do much of that because I didn't have soda.
That's right. You didn't have soda.
I didn't have any soda
to
squirt
on. Tom doesn't have much of the memory because he was soda deficient. His mother, you can't do it with milk. You can't do it with water.
Let's shake up
the water and squirt it at somebody just doesn't work. You know, I haven't done that as an adult. Have somebody come over your house and squirt soda. I don't think that would go over as an adult.
Use beer.
There we go. The adult way of doing it. How can we help you?
What is club soda?
Well, club soda is it's soda. That's it. It's carbonated water. It's carbon dioxide in water. That is club soda. And I have no idea why they call it club soda.
Because I do. I know. I bet. And this is a guess.
Go ahead.
Because you go to the club
and
you have a drink.
Uh-huh.
Scotch and soda.
Scotch and soda.
You go to the club.
The club.
And that's the soda that they have at the club.
I have a question. Have you ever gone to the club? Have you been a member of the club? How many people go to clubs? Hi, honey, I'm going to the club.
As Groucho Marx said, any club that would accept me, I wouldn't want to join. Remember, speaking of squirting seltzer, you don't watch television. You don't know the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
No, I remember as a kid, sure.
Remember the clown?
Yeah, the clown, yeah.
A little song, a little dance, a little seltzer in your pants. The clown from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Thank you. A little nostalgia.
Here on Zorba, Pastor, on your health. Zorba, see you next week.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web.
At zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime, day or night. 800-462-7413 is our number. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is the guy making our mics work. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us next time here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0818Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org. That's zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.